So the title of the talk is What's Really Going On? For the last couple of years I've been teaching course on the Paramis in Tel Aviv, also in the north, and suitable subject for reflection of how we are in daily life, because the Paramis are really about what happens to the personality when the practice kind of roots into the personality, and things change because we take ourselves more lightly, more freely, and how does that reflect out into who we are. So they're the Paramis, and there's traditionally 10 Paramis, and they, for example, integrity or morality, calmness, discernment, energy, so qualities, how they change, and it's an interesting subject. And one of them is always translated as honesty, and I always kind of missed it, because honesty, well, yeah, okay, it doesn't seem to be a big deal. And just recently I checked out the translation, and it's, of course, much more than honesty. It's authenticity and it's truth. And so this made me look again at that Parami, and so I decided to share it with you, the reflections that came up for me about this this Parami of authenticity. And authenticity is quite hard when you examine your life, because we are vulnerable human beings. We are vulnerable, we are sensitive, we are dependent, and we tend very, very easily to believe things that people tell us, to begin to talk out of our mouths things that we heard from others that we don't even know that they are from others, but we take ownership of all kinds of views, what we read in the newspapers, what suddenly things grow in us we don't even know. The voices in our own minds always coming from somewhere else. And so it's quite hard to, in all of that, to be authentic, to find out what is our real authentic voice. And we just think of our parents, for example, how much we are expressing them through us, even though we think we are sort of long ago left the nest and free beings, but other people sometimes notice it more clearly, how we are actually so much like them and we don't know it. So we're talking with the voices of others all the time, and it's quite hard to really recognize our authentic voice. And if we really want to be true to ourselves, what does that mean, to be true to ourselves? What self are we being true to? Who is the self we're being true to? How is that done exactly? These are not easy things. And it seems like, oh, authenticity is quite easy. It's not at all easy. And even here on the retreat, we may have that question coming up to us. What is my authentic experience? And I'll talk about this later on. But, you know, for example, we did metta the other night. So because there was guidance in a certain direction and a suggestion for the development of a certain inner power or quality, called a quality of love, does that mean it's an authentic experience? Well, it's coming from somebody else, essentially, sitting quietly, opening the real moment by moment experience what is the real experience? So again, not an easy question. But the truth is, it's much harder and much more painful to be non-authentic. So in some senses, we don't have a choice, because it's actually much more painful to be non-authentic than it is to be authentic. We get locked by being non-authentic. We get locked. We get closed into positions which stay with us and cause huge damage in our suffering. For example, positions of us versus them, which we take on. For example, the position of conflict, which becomes a fact of life. We grow up with it. So the conflict in the Middle East, we grow up with it, and we take it inside, and then it becomes real for us. And then we start thinking in that way, and we don't even know we're doing it. We just automatically create a them and an us kind of situation. And then, you know, how many of us are ready to go off to the West Bank and just go there and meet the people there? And so we get locked in, and it's a painful place. We get locked into them and us just in the street, in our neighbours. And we are constantly struggling with beliefs and illusions. I remember that when I first came to Israel in 1980 something, I spent 2 years without wearing my glasses, because I didn't want to see so clearly what I thought was an awful society. People aggressive, speedy, anxious, and unpleasant, and religious. So I preferred things to be blurred. Until I realized it was quite ridiculous. So I put them on again, so okay, I'm ready, guys. basically, because we are vulnerable, we so easily accept a consensus, muskamot. And then we take it inside, and we believe so much that is not really clear to us, is not really certain. But because of our vulnerability, we live in a sea of beliefs and assumptions, and mostly 90% we don't know them. So, and they give us immense suffering and a sense of imprisonment. So being non-authentic, in other words, not inquiring, is actually more painful. And the Buddhist teachings are very much about inquiry, and very, very much, I would say, uniquely in the teachings in the world spiritual, possible spiritual paths, the Buddhist teaching is emphasizing deep inquiry in a unique and very powerful and beautiful way, and basically the bottom line is asking what is my truth is much more important than asking what is going to make me comfortable. It's a sort of basic statement. What is truth is going to be much more important than what is going to make me comfortable. And why? Because what is truth will help to liberate us. What is going to make me comfortable will help to imprison us, make us dependent. And interesting, in relation to honesty, in the texts, there's some very, very strong stories about how important it is actually to be honest with your language. And a very famous text is when the son of the Buddha in the, you know, we don't know what really happened, but let's say this is the story, that the son of the Buddha, Rahula, when he joined the community of monks, and really he received the first lesson, he was about 7 years old, from the Buddha, and it was all about not lying, speaking truth, speaking honestly. And it was very, very graphic and almost scary. And I acted it out a little bit in the family retreat, because we had lots of children in the room here in the hall. And he did it with a bowl, and the Buddha said, you know, if he had water in the bowl, and he said, you know, if you lie, the spiritual life becomes like empty, like the bowl, and he poured out the water, or it becomes upside down, or it becomes thrown through the water away. Almost saying that if you don't keep honesty, you've thrown away the whole of your spiritual life. Well, that seems a very, very, almost like too strong. And he said, you know, if you lie, it's basically you can do anything. Any other immoral act starts there. Then everything collapses in terms of morality and integrity. That's very strong. And there was a very, very strong rules until today in the monks' community about not inflating your experiences when you go to the teacher, not building up things, not making things small, not pretending that you have experiences that you don't have. Very, very strong, almost punishments you get thrown out for this kind of thing. So there's a lot of emphasis on honesty. And and I think that part of it is that it kind of sets the stage for non-authenticity. If you're used to not being honest with your language, it creates a kind of mindset which leads to non-authenticity. It's like a training to be honest with your speech is like to be straight with your mind and to be authentic with your mind. So it's like the beginning place where in the speech, in the language, you're training for truth, and truth is so, so fundamental to the spiritual path that if you're not directed towards truth, you lost the path in a certain way. And there was a very strong, also a very strong advice, teaching against belief in beliefs or questions about the existence of God, or about the whether the world is created or not. Is there a creator? Is there not a creator? Many issues were. The Buddha said, I leave this undeclared. This I do not speak about. I do not declare it. And the reason is not only that it's not helpful, it's not useful to go through this process, but it actually undermines your spiritual search, which is about seeking, inquiring into what is, and not getting lost in concepts about and views and arguments and discussions about what is impossible to think about, and just getting lost in some non-authentic questions, which he likened to a row of blind men, one leading another, so none of them know where they're going. So the starting with honesty, that is, being very, very watchful over what it is that you say. There is practice, and the practice is inquiry, and the practice starts with the honesty, care about honesty, and then goes deeper into authenticity and into truth. There is a sutta in which this is discussed very specifically, a text which is very, very specific about this. And the text says, if you have a view, I have a view that, can be anything. Give me a view. any thought can be like the muezzin. I have a view about the muezzin that we just hear, that what he's saying. Can I have a view? Right. I don't know exactly what he's saying, but I have a view about it. For example, I have a view about you. You might have a view about me. Who am I? What I'm doing? You know, it's more or less anything. If you have a view, then if you say it's just a view, you're safeguarding the truth. You are protecting the truth. If you hear something and you acknowledge that you hear it, unlike what I was saying before, that the things that you take in yourself automatically and keep repeating them, and you don't know that they're for voices from someone else or somewhere else, but if you acknowledge this is what I've heard, you are protecting the truth. If you say, I have agreed to this opinion. This opinion seems to me to be fair enough. Then you're protecting the truth. You're not saying it exists. It is right. This is a fact. You're saying, you're acknowledging, you're taking responsibility for your choice here in having this view, or in, you're taking responsibility. I have heard this. So you're safeguarding the truth. But this is not awakening to the truth. There is another level altogether, which is beyond this sense of honesty, beyond authenticity, in a sense which is the way of awakening. And awakening to the truth comes in a much deeper, longer process of inquiry. But it starts with protecting the truth. There is a place there where the protecting the truth allows us to begin, or to inquire. And the awakening to the truth in this sutta is about us and how we are in terms of our attachments, our delusions, our illusions, and that when we say, I know something, or I see something, who is it that's saying this? That's the second part of this text. Who is it exactly? When someone, one of us says, I know, or I see, or I think, who is talking? And that's much more about the truth, the awakening to the truth. Who is talking? Is this person a person who is talking? Is he talking from, or he or she, from an awakened place, meaning a place without illusion, with clarity, with wisdom, without interests, without a self-interest, without aversion or desires that are inside this statement saying, I know, or investment. So it's coming from a very, very pure place. And that's the awakening to the truth. It's another level altogether. And I think that we can reflect that it's our path, really, to respect truth, to be watchful of it, and then to actually awaken to truth. In the sutta, it describes the Dharma in a phrase which is repeated again and again through the texts. It says, Dharma is hard to see, deep, subtle, beyond concepts, hard to realize in calmness and tranquility. We see it, and we realize the ultimate truth with our body and penetrate with wisdom. And I think there are two key words here. We realize it with our body, with our cells, in our cells, actually. But ta'im shalanu. Not concept, which is always, as I say, a questionable voice coming from other people. But we realize, truth is realized, the awakening to the truth is realized with our being, in our cells, in our tissues, in our deepest place. And the word penetrate, you know, to go really inside is another key word, to go in. And that's what we're doing here. We're actually not in concepts of conceptual dharma. We're actually sitting quietly without concepts, without discussion of what we need to do, what we don't do, what we do. We're actually just breathing, sitting, looking at ourselves in the mirror. That's what's happening here. And that is the Dharma. It's penetrating our experience and knowing it with our being, and not just conceptually, which is so often non-authentic. So with the energy of authenticity and respect for the truth and real interest in the truth, we start to look deeply in our practice and in our life. And if we phrase it, if we ask ourselves, for example, what do I really know? If we ask such a question, what do I really know? What is really going on? What do I really know? Somehow or other, the whole house of cards collapses. That question, if we really hold it, begins to undo the whole fiction, the whole construction. What do I really know? Like I said about the authentic voice. What is my real voice that doesn't come from parents, from this, from that, from that? That's a hard one. But if we keep asking that question, what do I really know? Somehow everything is deconstructed there. The constructions that hold us lose their power over us. Cuts through the beliefs. It cuts through the concept. I don't mean that we should necessarily go around asking this question in language, what do I really know, what do I really know, what do I really know? Although there are paths in the Buddhist world that do that. You know, the Zen teachers, Korean Zen teachers, for example, that's the practice. You go to the monastery and you just ask, what's this? What's this? What is this? What is this? What is this? And just keep asking. And but I think that in our practice, it's much more like having a sense of inquiry, which is the same thing. It's just not in this language of what do I really know that we repeat to ourselves like a mantra. It's more like a freshness of awareness of what is going on. Let me look under. What is really going on with me right now? It cuts through beliefs. It cuts through assumptions that we don't know the first that we have. it's interesting that in the Dharma, the sense of being a personality is described as a belief. In other words, we're not really somebody, we're a belief that we're somebody. We're not in the end a person, we're a belief that we are a person. That is expressed as belief. I am acting out a belief that I'm Stephen. And it's just an interesting way of putting it. It's an interesting way of looking at ourselves that cuts through the sense of solidity that gives us the pain of somebody, all the time having to be somebody, like Christopher said at the beginning of the retreat. We have a belief that we are who we are. And if we look at this belief, it goes to pieces, slowly, slowly. We have constantly beliefs about ourselves. I can't do this. I am depressed. I am no good at this. Critical minded, but judgments about ourselves. Or I'm great. Or I was great. Or I'm young, or I'm old. endless. They're all the masks and the labels and the descriptions that we apply to ourselves. They're all, in a sense, beliefs. They don't have any ultimate reality. It goes very, very deep. I am here and the world is there. The world is as I see it. There are facts in the world. This is a fact and this is a fact. Uvdot. I'm here watching the world and the world is what it is. It's a belief. When you ask what is it, what is going on, it begins to question that. There's a very famous story which many of you have heard, and I don't know whether it really happened, but it's funny, so I want to tell you. It sort of arrived in different books and in different teachers keep quoting it, so you may have heard it before, but anyway, it may have happened that a Zen teacher and a Tibetan Rinpoche were giving a talk somewhere in America, and the Zen teacher had it held up an orange. And that was his practice, which is to ask the question, what is this? So he asked the question, held up the orange and said, what is this? And there was a silence, and the Rinpoche didn't answer. What is this? And the Tibetan Rinpoche didn't answer. And he was, what is this? And the Tibetan Rinpoche turned to his translator and said something, and the translator turned to the Zen teacher and said, did you never see an orange before? there is a need for courage in all of this. It is often easier to seek for comfort. It sometimes feels somehow can be feel, well, I can't, this is difficult to find the authentic place in me. I'll turn on the TV and just go drink a beer. Let other people do it. It's all right for the Buddha, but it does need some courage to be really authentic. It does need some courage to inquire deeply. It does need some courage to ask a question, what is this, or what's really going on, or what's happening to me now. It needs some courage, some energy. But slowly, slowly, if we find ourselves at home in an atmosphere of questioning or of opening what is otherwise closed, constructed world, if we begin to feel ourselves at home, that gives us the energy, that gives us the interest. Our life then becomes just that much more interesting, and that gives us the fire to keep going. Because the questioning itself, the sense of inquiry, the sense of is itself empowering. Because as we lose, you know, as we lose our beliefs, our automatic life, something in us is empowered. We find ourselves more able to look at life in the eyes straight, stand on our ground and look at life in the eyes, because we're not buried under a pile of beliefs and assumptions and automatic kind of responses and other people's voices that would often undermine our power and our energy. And so it actually gives us power. But we have to have the courage sometimes to be in a place of uncertainty or of doubt or of not knowing or of paradox. And plenty of paradoxes in what we're doing. Things that are not worked out systematically, things that maybe seem like paradoxes or opposites that we have to hold together somehow. There's a Zen phrase that says, great doubt, great enlightenment. And I actually went to try and understand the source of this. The full quote is, small doubt, small enlightenment, middle doubt, middle enlightenment, great doubt, great enlightenment. And I actually checked out the source of this to try and understand what was meant by the word doubt. And again, we got problems in the translation. But doubt in this case means this sense of being with open inquiry and not coming to assumptions or beliefs about things, especially about self. It's not that we just, there is an issue of doubt or of confusion which can be paralyzing to us. And there it can have a negative kind of tone. So doubt and confusion can be a problem for us if it's a paralyzing kind of doubt. But the doubt in this case is much more about allowing things to be unknown or less known, allowing our concepts to kind of dissolve, and in their place allowing things to be less clear or less obvious or less assumed or less believed. So we need courage in a way to be there with unknown, with a sense of idea, the not known, the not knowing. There are always different points of view, and we have to sometimes hold them together. We had a discussion today on the dinner table in which we were kind of discussing or holding different points of view, one being that there really is no practice because the world is perfect and ultimate, so why practice? And then the other view would say, well, how, unless we practice, we will not really know that, so we need to practice. So it's kind of holding these conflicting or contrasting places is we can feel it here. Well, isn't it all about the spiritual life going out and just being with the birds and trees and just relaxing and feeling the world with and me with the world? And why do I need to sit here and breathe? which is quite hard work. And it's right. There is a place there, absolutely right. But at the same time, we need to sit here and breathe. And why? Because they both have places which contribute to something bigger. They're both needed. We climb up the mountain, and we have a direction to climb up the mountain, we have a path up the mountain. But why not look at the flowers on the way? And why not stop on a rock and just enjoy being on the mountain? And so not to stop on the rock and fall asleep and wake up 100 years later, or not to be so serious about, too serious about our path and make it all hard going. So there's kind of middle ways, and there's dialogues between different things, and there's paradoxes and so on. And we just weave our way through that. And if we don't take the concepts too seriously, it just provides interest rather than problems for us. And somehow or other, the doubts and uncertainties and the not knowing, usually if we keep with it, if we stay with it, in other words, we stay on the edge of things that are not clear, with an atmosphere of inquiry and authenticity. What do I really know? What is happening here? If we stay on that edge, it usually creates another layer of knowing. A new certainty often arises, a new understanding often arises. So these dynamic of questioning and of doubting the conceptual construction and being in the not knowing and allowing the knowing to the previous knowing to dissolve, and we often find ourselves with a new sense of knowing, something deeper, something more free, another quality of knowing, which again, as I said before, is with ourselves, our ta'im, our being, and not just in the world of concept. I want to quote T.S. Eliot here, who poem that is it really about this. You say I am repeating something I have said before. I shall say it again. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know, and what you own is what you do not own, and where you are is where you are not. And he's saying something very similar, that you can't go beyond the known with concepts about the beyond. The concepts about the beyond won't take you to the beyond. You have to be in the unknown to go beyond the known. You have to be the unknown. You have to go through the unknown to the beyond. And it's beautifully said. So how does this relate to us, to our practice here? I think that firstly, what we are essentially doing here in the quietness of the sitting and in going inside, and sometimes in the quietness of the walking and going outside, what we are essentially doing is looking in the mirror. That It's the magic of the retreat, in which we, in a way, close ourselves in a space in which we're all deeply looking in the mirror. The mirror may come up with comfortable or uncomfortable experiences. We may see, because we look in the mirror, things that come up. We may realize our own anger. We may realize our own limitation. We may also see our own joy and our own freedom. We may, you know, doesn't matter really. It's all the raw material. But if we are constantly wakeful and aware with this attitude of inquiry and questioning, what's really going on? What's authentic? What's the authentic experience here? Just that, and keep steady, looking in the mirror, seeing what comes up for us at every minute, being totally honest about this moment's experience. That's what we're doing, and that's the practice of letting go of the imprisonment in all the constructions and the automatic living. And it may feel personal. It may feel that, well, I'm just looking in the mirror, and it's my own issues, my struggle, my history, my story of my life, the stories going through, stupid stories, my soap opera, opera Sabon, that's passing by, that's all there is in the mirror. Okay, fine. But with if we are trusting and have the courage, with an atmosphere of inquiry, we're actually seeing a truth there. We're being honest and authentic with our experience. Yes, this is what it is. It's a soap opera called Stephen's soap opera, or Shelley's soap opera, whatever. That's what it is. But we have the courage to look at it, you know, in the eye level, and it will reveal itself as something else. This looking will help to dissolve it, to transform it, and it's not really also us, it's also the world. Every time we look at us, we're actually looking at the world. Every time we look at the mirror, we're actually looking at the world. The world and us are not sort of two universes, dimensions that don't touch each other. The world and us are intimate. We are, and the world are one. So when we're looking at the mirror, we are actually looking at the world as well as at ourselves. And that's why this process of inquiry is so important. It teaches us about ourselves, but at the same time about the world and our relationship, the world to us and us to the world, how this constant flow between the two, and the creation of how we are created by the world and the world created by us. The voices that we think are ours, that belong to the world, like parents and so on, shows how we are created by the world, and we create the world just in the same way. So this flow, when we never just look at our personal stuff, it's really that we look through us to the world. So all I can say at this point is, let's together let go of some of the certainties. Some of the things that we think of as facts, or as true, or as existing, or as real. Have the courage to look straight in the eyes at ourselves, and just be there in this inquiry. Just be there, just stay with it as we sit and walk and lie down and talk and eat. Just stay with that atmosphere of looking authentically at what's happening, what's really happening now. And with a little bit of power from courage, from the love, which we talked about as a power that helps us in this process, not with angst or a negativity, but with a love to look, to inquire in the silence. And we find that slowly, we actually don't need to hunt for the truth, because the truth is hunting for us. Thank you. So let's take a couple of minutes.